Hello, welcome to Object Matters, the official podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the museum. Today, for this episode, my guest is my colleague, Candice Richards, the Assistant Curator of the Nicholson Collection of the museum and an archaeologist. Welcome, Candice.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, really looking forward to today, but before we talk about the objects that you have selected from the collection for us to focus on today, could you first begin by telling our listeners about your role at the Chow Chak Wing Museum? What does the Assistant Curator of the Nicholson Collection, and what does that work involve?
Well, at the moment, it's been a really interesting kind of period for my job. As the assistant curator, I've worked on a lot of the exhibitions for the Nicholson Collection that'll be opening at the Chow Chak Wing Museum in November. And so a lot of it over the last 3 years has really been in-depth research of the collection itself, thinking of creative ways to put the collection together that'll interest not only a general public audience, but also obviously the University of Sydney audience that we hold. And a lot of that kind of work is then trying to liaise with the public and answer those questions that come in about items of the collection, about research for the collection, or even just new ways of engaging with material culture. So we've had lots of requests for photography, for 3D objects, for information about collectors, for information about historians, and it's really my job to facilitate a lot of that information and make sure it gets to the right people and the right specialists to help us out.
Now, I mean, obviously, as a curator of an archaeological collection, what is interesting is that your own background and your own knowledge in archaeology and your own fieldwork. Could you speak a little bit about your own work in the field and the various places that you have actually worked on excavations?
It's interesting, obviously, that you are the one asking this question, Craig, on the basis that you know very well my latest research in archaeology, and that is on your site at the Paphos Theatre Archaeological Project in near Paphos in Cyprus, where I'm really interested in understanding more about reuse and recycling of material culture. Not just in the ancient world, but how that ancient world and how material from the ancient world has been picked up and used again and again and again over time. And Cyprus is a really interesting place to do this because obviously as an island in the Mediterranean Sea, a lot of the resources actually have to be imported in the first place. So it kind of changes the way in which I think societies think about materials, if they're rarer or harder to get, how they actually then become a really valuable resource as a reused item. And I think that's really interesting for island economies quite specifically, and how a lot of what we do in Cyprus and in the Mediterranean really speaks to what happens in Australia and the Australian environment. Those connections are not necessarily obvious to a lot of Mediterranean archaeologists or why we work in the Mediterranean, but it does inform how we think about our own heritage here in Australia quite a lot. And I think that's kind of where my research is kind of really pushing and going at the moment in archaeology. But obviously I've worked in a whole range of different places in Australia, but also the Mediterranean, working in Cyprus. But I've also worked in the Balkans, in northern Macedonia, as it's now known. But when I worked there, it was the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And also working on the University of Sydney's projects in Serbia as well. So I've been fortunate enough to travel to a whole range of different places to learn about history in the past.
Today, we're here to talk about the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection and to talk about objects and what objects mean to us and how we can reflect upon them. So I guess, Candice, can I get you to tell us what item have you chosen from the collection today for us to focus on?
The item I've chosen is slightly unusual, I think, for many of people familiar with the Nicholson collection. I've actually chosen a French banknote from 1796. It's called the Promesse de Mandat Territorial. I apologise for my French accent. I cannot speak in a French accent. But basically, it's a French banknote that's a territorial banknote, so it can be used for the exchange of land, and would have been worth about 100 francs at the time that it was manufactured. Quite a beautiful kind of ephemeral piece in the collection. It's a beautiful kind of red print with calligraphy writing and has a really beautiful seal in the bottom corner of a neoclassical woman holding up a map of France sitting on a chest that I believe represents the treasury and the holdings and a symbol of, and has a cornucopia and a caduceus at her feet.
It's a lovely example of classical iconography being used in that neoclassical period, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I'll talk to you more about the note in detail in a second, but I suspect that many of our listeners, when they think of the Nicholson Collection, think of archaeological objects, you know, ceramic vases, marble sculptures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Within the collection, are there many other examples of this kind of modern, quote-unquote, ephemeral material?
We do have quite a fair bit of ephemera, and I'll dive into this as we go through the podcast a little bit more about this one in particular. But the ephemera that comes into the Nicholson Collection is some of the most interesting items to me, because they actually speak to the collectors themselves often. So we have things in the Nicholson Collection like beautiful cigarette tins from archaeological excavations that were used to store ceramic sherds and transport them to Australia directly from the digs. We do have things like banknotes and material like this. And the reason why it's in the Nicholson Collection is it's actually part of the Nicholson's numismatic collection. And while, yes, we are mostly known for our ceramics and sculpture from Greek and Roman, Egyptian and Middle Eastern history, we actually do have about 10,000 items in our numismatic collection that do speak to those ancient cultures, but also extends more into the modern period as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, just to give an indication of the breadth of the Nicholson Collection and the types of materials that a lot of people are not necessarily aware of, because often a lot of this material wasn't exhibited in the old Nicholson Museum, was it?
No, and this piece is part of the reason why I've chosen it, is that it will definitely be on display in the new museum. But yeah, it's definitely a modern kind of concept of museum curation and collection. That while our ethos and definitely our mandate is for ancient history and archaeological materials, the way in which things come to us, the collectors, the manner in which different ideas kind of permeate throughout history can be captured in the ephemera. And some of that is in archival records, which obviously we have an extensive archive that goes with the archaeological and antiquities collection. But some pieces like this actually do get registered into the collection themselves. So it's kind of, there's a whole range of different types of materials that make up what you see on display.
Yeah, you've kind of answered my next question in that. So forgive me for asking it, but you know, is there any particular reason why you chose this one for the podcast? I must admit that when you mentioned it to me, it was probably the last thing I would have expected you to have chosen, which says a lot more about me than you, I suspect, and all about the object. But what drew you to it?
Well, the reason why I've chosen the French banknote is actually the way that it came to the collection. So it's a French banknote. It's made in 1796, which people who are interested in modern history will realise is actually during the later years of the French Revolution. And the banknote itself actually comes out with the deflation of the currency in France, that as the revolution takes hold, money and commerce actually become incredibly difficult, and there's an overinflation that occurs, meaning that land notes like this need to be printed en masse. And actually, it was only in circulation for a year before it was completely devalued and had to be replaced. So it's a very small snippet of a really interesting and fascinating economic history of the French Revolution, which is not my specialty. But the reason how it came to our collection is actually that it was donated by the great grandnieces of Sir Grafton Elliot Smith in 1984. And so for those who are not aware, Sir Grafton Elliot Smith is a really interesting figure in Egyptology, and I'm sure, Craig, you'll ask me some more questions about him specifically. But Grafton Elliot Smith's great-grandnieces donated this item, this French banknote, along with a series of letters, a series of amulets and artifacts and mummy bandages that Grafton Elliot Smith himself collected in Egypt in 1903.
So the banknote itself, printed in France, mm-hmm. that has ended up in Egypt mm-hmm. at some point in 1796, only to be, you know, obviously passed through several hands, only to be eventually acquired by Australian-born Grafton Elliott Smith, who, you are right, we'll come and talk about in more detail in a moment. So, I guess, for those of us not necessarily knowing much about the history of Egyptology, why would there be French banknotes in Egypt in the late 18th century?
And this all comes down to, again, the French Revolution. Obviously, one of the primary figures out of the French Revolution is Napoleon Bonaparte, who then, after the French Revolution, in the very last years of the 1790s and then into the early 1800s, starts to dominate the European landscape. And he takes on the Ottoman Empire in the 1790s, specifically Egypt itself. And so there's a territorial dispute in which he tries to, invades quite specifically Egypt. And the French campaign throughout North Africa lasted a couple of years, around 1798 to around 1801. And it's during, while it was definitely a military campaign, Napoleon Bonaparte is interesting because, and interesting to Egyptology, because he travelled with a series of artists, scientists, intellectuals, savants, as they were known to at the time. And they set about, during the Napoleonic Wars, recording artifacts, making detailed notes of the antiquities that they discovered, uncovering a whole range of different important monuments of ancient Egyptian history, and created this series of plates and books that were printed back in Europe that became almost a touchstone to an ancient world that Western Europe had really kind of forgotten about almost. And because of Napoleon's enthusiasm for this ancient culture, or really Napoleon's savant's enthusiasm for this ancient culture and the science and the medicine, the mummification, all of those bits and pieces that they kind of uncovered during their period in Egypt in the 1790s, they took that back and really spurned a wave of interest throughout France, but then spilling out into Western Europe and the UK in particular to learn more and know more about this enigmatic and mysterious ancient culture. And so what's really interesting to me is the fact that the banknote itself would have probably ended up in Egypt during this period of Napoleonic Wars. And as we all know, you know, how many coins have you dropped while you've been traveling? How much random detritus happens as we move around the world? And I imagine that, you know, we can't be certain exactly how this banknote came into Grafton Elliott Smith's possession, but it seems most likely, given the other material that it was sent back with it, with Egyptian amulets, that he collected it during his time in Egypt in the 1901, about 100 years later than when it was manufactured.
I mean, the Napoleon's campaigns, of course, were so pivotal in terms of the development of Egyptology as an academic discipline, as you say, within France first, but much wider eventually. But, you know, things like furnishing the Louvre Museum and the Rosetta Stone and so on. So it's kind of interesting that here in Australia we've got this little connection to that campaign as well, don't we?
Yeah, that it was definitely the spark. So what's really interesting about this piece in particular is the fact, and why I've chosen it, is that it's actually going on display in an exhibition called Foreign Obsessions in the New Museum, and I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute. But it's going on display alongside a portrait of Napoleon Bonaparte from the Maclay's Historic Photograph Collection, as well as a beautiful edition of the Monuments de l'Egypte, which is the book that Napoleon's savants produced. And it's not an original copy, it's actually a copy from the 1800s that was transcribed and rewritten by Champollion, who's actually the guy who translates hieroglyphs for the first time. So it's layers upon layers upon layers of Egyptology. For those who are super Egyptology nerds, this will float all of tickle all your buttons, I think. But yeah, it's this layering of that Western understanding is the launch of this exhibition, Phoronic Obsession. So the French banknote, a touchstone to Napoleon's campaign, alongside the other ephemera that he was produced, that really sparked, you know, this idea of ancient Egypt in Western cultural kind of fascination.
Fascinating. You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. Candace Richards of the Nicholson Collection is our guest this episode. Now, Candace, can you talk to us a bit more about Grafton Elliott Smith, the ultimately the the Australian connection in terms of the Note story. Who was he?
So Grafton Elliot Smith is a really interesting guy. He's an Australian, first and foremost, and a graduate of the University of Sydney. He undertook his medical training in Sydney in 1899,
wasn't it?
Around then. I'm just double-checking the date. So in 1888, he entered the University of Sydney, and over the next couple of years completed his degrees, winning several scholarships and awards. And he started becoming really interested in, well, human anatomy was really his speciality, especially concept of the brain of monotremes and marsupials, which was what his first thesis and first publications were about. And those kinds of works really put him on the intellectual kind of brainwave of the time, because medical science is still in its infancy at this point. Neuroscience obviously didn't exist yet, and he's one of the founding fathers of neuroscience in general. And his work led him to become the professor of anatomy at the University of Sydney after he graduated. And then in 1900, he was appointed to be a professor of anatomy for the Egyptian School of Medicine in Cairo. And so actually took off from Australian shores via, he'd already been to England a few times, and via England came to Cairo. And it was in Cairo that he really took up the role and started doing in-depth analysis of ancient Egyptian mummies.
Right. And that's interesting too, because, I mean, he is really one of the pioneers of that generation, people like Margaret Murray, but, you know, that sort of late 19th, very early 20th century, the examination of human remains from Egypt goes from being very much a curiosity show to the beginnings of something scientific, although by modern standards we would question. But could you talk more about that?
Indeed. He's really interesting because as soon as he gets the appointment to Cairo, his analysis of mummies and mummification really starts to ramp up. He starts working quite specifically at the Cairo Museum to unroll mummies, and this is obviously something that we would not do in a modern setting. But at the time, it was quite common to try and understand the anatomy of ancient Egyptian mummies through unrolling them and unwrapping them, taking detailed notes and studying them. And what was interesting is that at the time that Grafton Elliot Smith was in Egypt, it was at the same time that the government was really interested in changing the Aswan Dam and raising the level of the dam. And so he had access to thousands upon thousands of mummies that were being excavated directly at the time. And so because he had this large corpus to work with, he started to really be able to understand mummification processes, the anatomy, and used a lot of what he learnt from Egyptian mummification to inform his ideas about the human in general, or the human body and the human brain, and how anatomy and morphology worked at that point in time. And so during his couple of years there, he was pioneering in the fact that he did not only unroll mummies to understand them, he also pioneered things like X-ray analysis of mummification, thinking that he could learn a lot more about the internal structure of a human through X-rays, and you could X-ray mummies while they were still wrapped and actually see the internal person, which was really fundamental and kind of changed and really set a course for scientific analysis of mummification for the next 100 and 150 years up until today. He really set us on that path. And you are right. He was not working in isolation. There were Egyptologists starting to build up a different kind of university structures, especially at Manchester, where Margaret Murray is the very first woman who gets a professorship. And she, not just in Egyptology, but in any discipline, and she famously unwrapped several mummies for an anatomy class in front of them, which was published in the papers at the time. And she was really spearheading this kind of idea of unwrapping mummies and understanding anatomy at the same time Grafton Elliot Smith was. So it's a really interesting time for understanding medical science, Egyptology, and where that leads us throughout history is kind of wrapped up in these few individuals at this time and period, time and place.
The kind of the birth of the application of forensic approaches to the study of the bodies, isn't
it? Yeah. And it's also at the time when archaeology is just starting as a discipline. So these things are all sparking at the same time to kind of meld together to understand the past.
Right. How is his work and the work of his contemporaries viewed through the lens of the 21st century? Because, of course, he's using cutting-edge technology in the way that today we would use, you know, MRI scans, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
but ethically, you know, how do we think about, what's the general consensus about the approaches taken by that generation?
Well, what's interesting is obviously the approaches that used were definitely wrapped up in the time in which they were doing things. So things like unwrapping mummies at this point in time for science is something that today ethically is incredibly dubious and something that no professional archaeologist would undertake, because these are specimens, sure, for archaeological analysis, but they are actual humans who lived in the past with their own ideas and thoughts and feelings and a life unto themselves, that, yes, studying them and understanding who they were and you know, diseases or bone structure or the influence of the culture in which they were living on themselves, we can learn a lot about people, what they ate, how they were, from analysis of the human themselves. But obviously there is a lot of complications when it comes to understanding ancient cultures through the human remains. Not all people are comfortable looking at human remains. There's a lot of different cultures around the world today that have very strict practices upon, based on their own cultural beliefs or religious beliefs as to what's acceptable and how close you can come to human remains, or even that if it is acceptable to be really engaged or looking at these. And I think part of Grafton Elliott Smith's legacy is really wrapped up in the idea of colonialism. You know, a lot of what he wrote from an Egyptological point of view, yes, he is the father of Egyptology, and yes, he did do a lot of work on mummification and you know, led us down this path of scientific discovery. But at the same time, his ideas were really wrapped up in colonialist ideas, which are inherently racist. And when he was examining bodies around the world, he really... you know, was a big proponent of what's a cultural diffusion model of the development or evolution of humans, in which he really advocated for a Mediterranean-based kind of cultural diffusion spread around the world, and you could link a lot of different cultures back to Egypt, which has been 100% disproven. Mm. And, you know, his papers were controversial at the time. He passed away in the 1930s, but... You know, even in the 1930s, some of his ideas were incredibly controversial and radical, that not everybody subscribed to his kind of ideas of cultural diffusion models. And that legacy is really interesting here at the University of Sydney, because he did analyse other aspects of the Maclay collections, published on those, and with some really dubious claims, yeah, and links between Egyptian mummification and cultures in Australia, the Torres Strait, for instance. So it's a really problematic figure. Mm. And there's a lot of ways in which you can talk about Grafton Elliott Smith's story, but I think it's really important to really encompass all of these different aspects and to think about the ways in which these kind of ideas of the, you know, the turn of the century, the 1900s, were really wrapped up in some really colonial concepts of superiority and racist ideas about how culture spreads. So it's definitely important to acknowledge that at the same time as understanding his influence on Egyptology, mm-hmm, and Western kind of archaeological science.
So the complexities of his thought processes over the decades as well.
Yeah.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. Now, Candice, I know you've been doing a lot of work, not just in terms of the banknote that we're discussing today, but across the collection in terms of the concept of object biographies. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that and the implications for modern curatorial practices in terms of understanding the material within a collection?
Yeah, an object biographical approach to curation, but also to archaeology, which is where I really kind of am interested in pursuing more about object biographical approaches to material culture, is really trying to fundamentally understand not just that an object is related to one piece of history or one idea or one time frame, but rather each object in itself contains a biography. It can change hands, it moves around. You know, there's somebody who makes the object in the first place, there's somebody who might receive that object in the ancient world, as a gift, or as a they might purchase it and have that as a part of their own life. It can get passed on from generation to generation, or it can be interred in the ground in a grave. Then the object continues to have a life after that through the excavator, if it's an archaeological object, through the people who hold on to it and really kind of think about it later and what it represents, because objects are tied to the times in which they're made, but they're also really tied to the times in which they're discovered and the times in which they're valued by humans and to be put into a museum collection. And that is really interesting and at the heart of what I'm trying to pull together in an exhibition, well, the Phoronic Obsessions exhibition quite specifically, because the full title of this exhibition is Phoronic Obsessions, Ancient Egypt, an Australian Story. And what I've tried to do throughout it is really pull together the different strands, not just the Egyptological history of an artifact, but also the modern stories that are tied up with those artifacts. So we have not just the French banknote that's obviously tied up to Napoleon's campaign in Egypt and what that meant to sparking an idea of Egyptomania or Egyptology. It's also connected to somebody like Grafton Elliott Smith and all of his kind of concepts and ideas and why he thought this was valuable enough to hold on to. But also throughout the show, there's lots of different things like the collections of World War One and World War Two soldiers who traveled to Egypt as a part and did a lot of their training for World War One and World War Two for Anzac soldiers were set up in Egypt. And part of their downtime was being able to do things like visit the pyramids and see antique dealers. And some of them were lucky enough to be wealthy enough to purchase real artifacts as well as imitation artifacts. And so, you know, there's stories connected there. And part of what we're telling also is the story of, say, somebody like Flinders Petrie, who's called the grandfather of Egyptology because of the way in which he excavated material. But again, that's wrapped up in the time in which he's excavating. And so this concept of object biography is thinking about using an object in and of itself, not just to an object is not neutral and museums are not neutral in the stories in what they tell. And so an object can touch all these many facets and thinking about an object in a complete way or a more biographical function allows you to tap into these different types of stories and really think about how they were collected, why they were collected, what social culture does it fit into when it was collected, how does it represent the ideas of the people who collected it, and the stories it can tell in those kind of multiple facets.
Really contextualizing across a whole range of contexts, isn't it? Just on that note, in terms of collections passing on, how did these effectively personal effects of Grafton Elliott Smith end up with his great nieces? Did he pass them directly or did they flow through the family?
No, so Grafton Elliott Smith collecting them while working in Cairo, and some of the items he actually sent are snippets of bandages taken from the mummies that he unrolled as a part of his work and sent them with letters to his nephew, William Penfold. And what's really interesting is the fact that the letters in themselves contain a lot of the archaeological detail and they contain a lot of the information about the mummies and the work of Grafton Elliott Smith while he was doing it. But the letters are all written by his wife, Kathleen, not by Grafton Elliott Smith. And her letters are really interesting because they show her extensive knowledge of Egyptology, that she definitely knew what was going on and what Grafton and her husband was up to at the museum and was relaying that to their nephew, William, back in Australia. And so there's multiple letters in the archives go with the individual items. And part of the reason why I've chosen this banknote is that it's actually been one of my curatorial little fun spots, in that I was doing some work for the Phoronic Obsessions exhibition, like thinking about the Grafton Elliott Smith collections and what stories we could tell from the variety of artifacts that he had and sent to William. And then from William, he gave them to his nieces, Evelyn and Elizabeth. Elwyn and Elizabeth were William's nieces who were the ones that actually donated the items in 1984 to the Nicholson. But what's really interesting about them, and the reason why I was thinking about Grafton Elliott Smith and what can we do, and you know, I was thinking, okay, well, what is in the archives? And I started going back through the archival material, and that's when I started reading the letters and coming across the different envelopes. And I discovered that in some of the envelopes that were sent to the Nicholson still contained some of the mummified material in the archives. Oh, so we removed some of the mummified material, including a lock of hair.
Wow.
Mummy bandages, and they were registered into the collection associated with the donation from the 1980s. And a part of the ephemera was this banknote. And the decision was made in 2017 that we should really register this item in the collection, that it's not necessarily archival material, but rather can go into the numismatic collection as an example of obviously the 1790s French Revolution, monetary culture. But also in 2017, we're already looking towards the Chow Chak Wing Museum. And as we've brought all the collections together, there's been a lot of discussion between myself as a curator of antiquities and archaeology, but also my colleagues in historic photography, anthropology, in natural history, about what kind of materials belong in which collections and how we can use each other's collections or really kind of explore each other's collections to tell these stories. Mm. And so Browning Obsessions itself, while it definitely has a lot of antiquities and artifacts in it, it has rare books, it has a lot of historic photography, and draws upon the specialist knowledge of my colleagues as much as myself.
So it's a far more holistic approach, isn't it? It's not just ancient Egypt through the ideas of, or through ancient Egyptian artifacts. It's,
indeed. Yeah. And there's even a John Power work from the University Art Collection that's been incorporated into the collection, because he, and I'm sure Ian's podcast on Power was incredibly informative about his life. Mm. But also he, while in England, can, you know, there's a certain kind of elite and there's a certain kind of hopefully that will hang out and talk to each other, and especially at this kind of time frame. Yeah. He got to know Margaret Murray and did an amazing poster for one of her lectures, Bournemouth, that's in the exhibition as well. So we've connected all these kind of individual dots between the collections to think about, why do Australians care about Egyptology?
Yeah, fascinating. I can't wait personally to see it, and I'm sure our listeners can't either. To bring it back to the banknote, how do you find yourself responding to it when you see it? You know, and while we're in the process of installing the exhibition, I imagine you've seen it a few times recently. How do you feel about it?
Well, it's weird. It is an odd object. You're right. It is a strange object for me to kind of pick from the collection, because I obviously have an emotional reaction to a lot of our objects. As one of our colleagues knows, I do call them friends in the storeroom. And, you know, my speciality and background is in Mediterranean archaeology. I know far more about the classical world and the Hellenistic world than I do about the Egyptian world. But what I've been most interested in, and why this object in particular speaks to me, is because it is so lightweight. You know, as somebody who's used to working with marble and archaeological detritus in Paphos, but also working with the ceramics of the collection, this is possibly the lightest artifact that we have. So it's that weird, it has a real sense of ephemera to it, that real sense of a piece of wind will just take it away. Yeah. And I think that's what's really interesting about it.
The question I ask every guest on this podcast is the one I'm going to ask you right now. In one word, if you could pick one single word, what does the banknote, what does the object signify for you?
Mm. It is a tricky question, but I suppose in one word, colonialism.
Yeah.
For all the reasons that I've talked about, you know, it does connect to that it connects to the French Revolution. It connects to the fact that you know, the French were colonizers just as much as the English were, and you know, the war and kind of invasion of Egypt and attempt to take over some of the Ottoman territories, you know, it does speak to this colonialist idea. 1790s is the, you know, ripe for colonialism. Yes. Around the world. Yeah. And the impact that had upon First Nation cultures is devastating, and devastating to this day. And so it does connect with those ideas more than anything else, I think.
Yeah, no, fantastic. It's a really interesting response. I guess to wrap things up, when our listeners get the opportunity to actually see Pharaonic Obsessions in the flesh, when we open on the 18th of November, what would you like them to think about when they actually see the banknote? Is there anything beyond colonialism and other aspects that we've talked about today?
No, I think that's the thing. Like, as in, it's maybe the second or third object of the exhibition. And, yeah, I think that is the thing to think about, that as you explore the rest of Phronic Obsessions, and we do tell some fun stories, we tell some interesting stories, we tell some, I think, I find some wacky ideas that I came across in things like the paper of recipes for nougat and jelly that were printed alongside the news of excavations at Abydos and things like that. So there's a lot of kind of hidden pockets of fun, I think, through this exhibition. But knowing and thinking about this is one of the first pieces is that, you know, the back of it does come off this kind of idea of colonialism and invasion and what does that mean and how has that affected how we think about Egyptology. And at different points in time, we forget about that aspect because we get wrapped up in the idea of discovery and wonderment at Egyptian culture, which I love.
Yes.
You know, part of the reason why this show came about was because one of the main questions that we get asked and always have done is visitors will come into the Nicholson, see some of our Egyptian material on display, particularly the mummy coffins that we have on display, and go, huh? How did that get to Australia? And so this exhibition is really built around trying to answer that question.
Yeah.
How did it get to Australia? And why does Australia care about this obsessive, fabulous ancient culture?
Yeah.
But it is this idea that there's lots and lots of individual stories that make up our obsession, and that some of them are really wonderful and ideas of discovery, and some of them are wrapped up in a whole range of different ideas that are about the cultural history of the last 200 years of kind of colonial endeavour.
Oh, fantastic, Candice. I can't wait to see it, for one. I'm sure our listeners can't either. That's been fascinating. Thank you so much. That, you know, one piece of paper has taken us from ancient Egypt to the French Revolution to the early 20th century to here in Australia in 2020. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us today, Candice.
Thanks, Craig. Anytime.
No, it's lovely. I'll have you back on to talk about something else in a future episode. You've been listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. I hope you can join in for a future episode. Object Matters is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pays our respect to the traditional owners.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.